Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Scaffold is supported by the Architecture Foundation, bringing new voices to the conversation about architecture in London and around the world. For more information and upcoming events, visit architecturefoundation.org.uk. I'm Matthew Blunderfield, and you're listening to Scaffold. In this episode, I speak with James Taylor Foster, curator of contemporary architecture and design at ArkDes in Stockholm. Prior to his post there, James wrote for the popular architecture website ArkDaily and co-curated the Nordic Pavilion at the 2016 Venice Architecture Biennale. He's a prolific writer whose work covers contemporary design and culture in a way that feels expanded, adventurous, and unorthodox. Reading James's work, whether it's about the architecture of cruising, the craft of Swedish video game design, or the future of the museum as we know it, you really get the feeling of being fully immersed in something immediate. And it's this kind of close looking at the present that's brought to bear on an exhibition that James recently created called Weird Sensation Feels Good, the first of its kind to explore ASMR, that tingly, soothing feeling triggered by specific sounds, touch, and movement. And this exhibition that James curated, it's specifically about how ASMR has given way to new internet cultures, as well as new fields of creativity. The exhibition originally opened at ArkDes in 2020, and now it's moving to the Design Museum in London, where it's opening in May of this year. I was particularly excited to talk to James, not only because of his approach to writing and making exhibitions, but also because of the kinds of people he's worked with. His list of collaborators includes the likes of OKRM, Shumi Bose, Jack Self, Max Creasy, and Space Popular, all of whom have been guests on this podcast. So in a way, I kind of feel like I've been tracing a constellation that James himself has also drawn. We spoke via Zoom in March of 2022. I was in London and he was in Stockholm. So without any further ado, here is my conversation with James Taylor Foster. I hope you enjoy it. Okay. And I mean, to be honest, I wasn't sure how to kind of approach this conversation. So bear with me if it's a bit...
I'm not your usual interviewee.
That is true. yeah, you're a difficult... figure to pin down in a lot of ways. I mean, you're a curator.
Yeah.
And your focus, it seems to be increasingly centered on the here and the now. You're interested in virtual expression, connection, and communication. And you're also interested in the emergence of new cultures and aesthetics. But you came to this through architecture. And it seems like architecture remains a base from which to explore contemporary culture, especially and almost paradoxically now, as our culture is increasingly decentered, disembodied, and intangible. And I want to start by having you tell me about your relationship to architecture. I understand you studied architecture as a part one, and then gradually transitioned into this curatorial role. So can you tell me that story?
Yeah, it's not an easy story for even me, having done it, to relate. But I studied architecture. And I'm if you want to describe me as an architect, as it were, which, you know, I do sort of like to think that I'm within that world, but I'm a remarkably unqualified one. I'm not a massive, like by any academic standards, you know, I'm, you know, you wouldn't hire me, but it goes very far back. I mean, I remember my grandparents telling me when I was a teenager that when I was a child, I used to draw bricks as like endless bricks, you know, like some sort of obsessive compulsive thing. And I was obsessed with buildings and architecture. And they said to me that I had two goals as a child. One was to either become an architect or to become a priest. And they sort of asked me, like, why did you want to become a priest? And I said, well, you got a free house. You know, it was like the vicarage was what attracted me rather than the lifestyle per se. Yeah, and I think that studying architecture became almost an obvious decision for me. It was a life goal. And off I went, and I studied a bachelor's, and I met some really interesting people through that, some very interesting ideas. I'm convinced that architecture as an education teaches you above all a way of thinking rather than the ability to draw or the ability to whatever. And you could say under that it's also essentially an education in communication, because I do not believe that architects build. In fact, it really infuriates me when that phrase is bandied around. Architects communicate through drawings, but also most importantly through words, both verbally and written. And that was the aspect, I think, of the education to me that really, really fascinated me. That you could imagine something and almost will it into existence through communication. And so, I mean, I guess standing from the position I'm in now, there's a lot of post-rationalization you could do about this journey. But on the one hand, it's always been very clear to me that I want to operate within the sort of expanded field of architecture and design. But building something is not necessarily a goal for me anymore. I think it was at some point, because let's face it, architecture education on the most part is essentially an ego building process. It sort of convinces you that you should make a physical mark on the world, but I'm not entirely sure we should.
I heard that you published your first book at the ripe old age of 17. Is this true? It was a book on impressionist painting?
Yeah, if not early. I mean, it might have been 17. I had an amazing... I remember when I was at secondary school, I really wanted to study art history. And it wasn't available because it was a state school, you know? I didn't go to some sort of public school where art history is a given subject. And so I convinced the school to let me do an A-level in art history, being the only student. And the only reason that they allowed that to happen is because someone called Helen Trimble, who was the sort of the head of the art department, dedicated a lot of time to me to sort of take me through that process and sort of stand behind me doing the A-level. And I did it. You know, I remember being in the exam room, it's the only one in the middle of this massive hall doing an A-level in art history. And that I was that process, I became very, very interested in two figures: Michelangelo, the greatest bad gay of the early art historical world, and Monet, Claude Monet, which are two radically different figures. But I was interested, I think, with Michelangelo in how his sculptures were essentially rooms. They dealt with rooms in a very specific way. And also he was a kind of megalomaniacal, crazy guy. And Monet, you know, I was also interested in one particular thing with Monet, which is the Nanfia series of the Musée de l'Orangerie, which is a space that he designed to house these murals, which you can still go and visit. And it's an unbelievable space. It's sort of almost like a James Turrell work, where you see these vast canvases, these vast murals in this these two elliptical rooms. You know, so I don't know. Yeah, but then I did publish these little, very naive essays, more as an exercise. No, I mean, I think for me, it's like when I was that age, the idea of publishing something was almost impossible to even contemplate. So I just did it myself.
I think it's just important to, because the way you're speaking about this, it's very matter of fact, the way that you cultivate this interest in these two particular artists. But we just have to remind ourselves that this is you as a 16-year-old. and that I'm sure you get this a lot, but I have to address it again because it feels to me like an elephant in the room. Like, most 16-year-olds, first of all, wouldn't take up this deep interest in artists like Michelangelo or Monet, let alone publish a book about them. And I mean, you're 29 now. Looking at you, though, your hair is gray. You have this kind of...
Well, it's salt and pepper. It's salt and pepper. I think we describe it.
You look, and I suspect you always looked much older than you are. And the way you speak and the way you carry yourself, I had no idea that you were the age you are. And there's a kind of, I think there was a shock for me at describing just how much you've done and how little time. I think at the beginning of the conversation, listeners just need to be aware of that context, that there's a precociousness at a very young age, an interest in the world of art, that you're bringing into your foray into architecture. And so, in a way, it makes perfect sense that coming out of your bachelor's of architecture, it seems like you went right into the world of criticism, of publishing, of writing. And so...
Before then, yeah.
Yeah. Can you just walk me through that trajectory?
Yeah, I mean, something to say maybe first was that, yeah, that there's always been a certain precociousness to sort of the way that I follow instincts and interests. And I mean, now, if you want to put it mildly, it's just you'd say that I'm just kind of curious, but that curiosity for me is always, it's always important to translate that curiosity into something. Like, I'm not particularly interested myself in just being curious and sort of sitting with that. I want to sort of see what I can do around that, or what I can, who I can collaborate with, or like what might come if this strange interest that I nurture slightly, if it's taken a step further. And I think that obviously as I've become more engaged with more serious contexts, or I've gained more responsibility or whatever, then it becomes really hard not to lose that. But I think it's actually become a fairly critical aspect of the way that I practice. And I don't think personally it's changed since I was a young teenager. I can personally thread a very simple line from there to now. And I suppose that also starts to answer a little bit of your question. When I was studying architecture, the thing about the way that architecture degrees are sort of organized is that they're organized for, I think, a certain kind of person, which not everybody always fits into. They often have quite strict syllabuses in terms of format and also time delivery. Now, I graduated with a first from that degree, and I also, you know, won a sequence of awards for that kind of stuff. But I only spent 50% of the degree time doing the degree. Like, absolutely, I did not. It was too much time given to us. So in that time, that I remember specifically, there was a call for interns at Arc Daily. And I thought, that would be fun. I can do that. I've got time to sit and write stuff. And it was really sort of, I got the internship, and it was a kind of content production thing, right? I was just sat remotely from my apartment, doing what I was told. But in so doing, also then able to sort of tap into a more global, like the most global understanding of the architecture discipline, because that's what Arc Daily was then and has remained for some time, is the only, let's say, media company within architecture that publishes in Mandarin, Portuguese, Spanish, and English simultaneously. So it was also a complete baptism of fire into also understanding how architecture is understood in different contexts and different languages. I mean, at that time, I'd never, you know, I had zero relationship to Mandarin or zero relationship to Portuguese or Spanish, but I had a relationship to English, because from as early as I can remember, I've always been interested in trying to be a little bit better than average at English, which is actually quite hard to do, you know. Writing or being able to sort of handle a language beyond just the day to day is a lifelong learning exercise. But I started interning, as it were, at Arc Daily. Very quickly, I realized that this was fun, and I got to know all the people there very closely. We became friends, and then as I took the next steps, I continued until I became an editor, while also working in practice in the Netherlands. And
you were working at Mekaneer, right?
Exactly, I was working at Meccano for a while, with a really interesting and diverse team of people, also mainly working on, let's say, research to large-scale historical projects or public projects.
Mm-hmm. I kind of want to hold on the Arc Daily experience for a moment before we move on, and just try and understand, because this website or platform is international and wildly popular and very widely read. And in a way, it was you cutting your teeth as an architecture writer, but not for the kind of audience that many architects would associate with architecture writing, which is, to some degree, unfortunately, quite rarefied, elitist, conceptual, or opaque and obtuse, especially when architects write about architecture. It's very hard to often make sense of what's going on. But the audience that Arc Daily is writing for is very popular and very general in some ways. And so what did that do to your understanding of what it meant to write about architecture? How did it change the way you wrote about the built environment?
Arc Daily was started as a blog by the two Davids, David Basulto and David Asayal, at the dawn of Web 2.0. And the success of Arc Daily in terms of its quantitative metrics is sort of lost a bit to the mists of time. But it became something out of Santiago de Chile, you know, out of, let's say, not out of a European context or a North American context, but out of a place that was unexpected at the time. And from the very start, I think, David instilled a sense of, I don't know how you would describe it necessarily, but a sense of openness or publicness. There was not, certainly when I came, a strict understanding of rigor or what rigor meant. It was about, let's just get it out there. Let's just tell everybody. Whether it was the archive, which, you know, ultimately that's what Arc Daily was and always has been. It was an archive of projects. Not perfectly organized, not organized anywhere near to the level of rigor that a museum's archive might be, but it was just about putting it out there and trying to show everybody that this is happening. And I think the trends that you could spot, and you probably still can, from that collection of projects will not be relevant really for a while. We'll look back on that archive and we'll see a decade, or even more than a decade, of architecture being shaped around the world. Mm-hmm. And responding to certain situations, whether they're economic or climate related, or you can start to be able to trace certain movements as certain architects graduate from school and then get together and then coexist and develop something, whether that is in Argentina or in China. And that, I think, struck me. I mean, I bought into this, right, this idea, but at the same time, myself and Becky Quintal and the other teams, she was the sort of head of the content across multiple languages at the time when I sort of joined. We understood that we wanted to still do this, but we also wanted to do it as well as we possibly could. We wanted to try to be accessible, but also not make mistakes. And it's really, really difficult when you're publishing 50 articles a day to not make mistakes.
That was the volume.
Yeah, that was the volume, or even more sometimes. And then translating those things and getting them out in Mandarin as quickly as possible, or sometimes something was written in Spanish and we went to Brazilian and then we had to translate it to English. And it was also, looking back, I mean, it was an incredible machine of extremely dedicated people. We were all completely sort of lost. We worked so much to try to bring this, and we never really knew who the audience was. We just, it was sort of like everybody and nobody, you know? And so off we go, sort of continuous publishing. And I think that ultimately, this for me taught me not necessarily how to write. You know, I've learned how to write from in different ways, but it taught me the importance of culture. It also taught me a lot about how the power of the internet, the power of connectivity can be used for good and bad. And it has informed the way that I see the world, my own openness to things that I might not know about. I think it was all shaped by just being bombarded for years with ideas, with people's imagination, you know, in the form of text and images, plans and sections.
And also, I imagine a much deeper understanding of how people are engaging with the writing that you're doing.
Yes, I mean, I think ultimately the
maybe not. I mean, engagement's a pretty general term, but I mean, you can tell what takes and what doesn't, what goes viral and what doesn't, what's popular and what's overlooked, just through the way that content published on the internet is monitored.
Yeah, I mean, all I will say is I think it fueled and reinforced my intuition.
And you're so immersed. You use the words trends and movements. I mean, you're writing for a platform like Arc Daily, being a writer on the internet. When was this period? You said the beginning of Web 2.0. So what is that?
Well, I think Arc Daily was founded around 2006, I think. I'm not sure the exact origins, but like I said, it's a bit misty because it started as Plataforma Arquitetura and then Arc Daily came a bit later.
But you're immersed in like this rapid acceleration of aesthetic and architectural trends, and I imagine trying to wade through that and make sense of it, to parse it. And this sounds like it's the training of a curator.
Totally. It's a completely unorthodox training of a curator. I mean, I remember I would read every single email that came into my inbox, and this was ridiculous amounts, overwhelming amounts. We would receive particularly a lot of emails from photographers, because for photographers it was, you know, an easy way to publish some work and be seen very, very widely, which hopefully might lead to something else. No, but there were too many. I remember me and a colleague opening an email from Lowry and Ginitau very early on, and it was a photograph of a building taken through the bare concrete apartment of someone who faced that building. And I just said, this is brilliant, you know, this is brilliant in comparison to the intuition that I'm building. And then, let's say a curatorial act takes place, then we reach out to Lowry and say, we want to work with you. We want to publish your work. And that led to a relationship, which is still I have today with Larian, and who has become, I think, one of the most interesting architectural photographers operating globally right now. Extremely ambitious person who wants to be in the thick of things. And that's also something that we picked up on. But simultaneously, you know, of course, there were all sorts of debates around Arc Daily. I would get attacked online. Arc Daily would get attacked online. People felt, I think, that at that time that Arc Daily had undue power and let's say, I think people felt that we weren't necessarily taking our responsibility with that power. And I'm talking about people who wanted things to be published in a highly edited way. You know, I think that the issues people had with what we were doing at Arc Daily at the time was that we were not editing, but of course we were editing. Of course we were editing. We were making micro decisions as a team constantly and trying to subtly shape, let's say, the content that we were given, or let's say mediated before it was published out into the world. And a lot of that was just about balance.
And I mean, it sounds like during this period you're establishing a network. Also, this seemed to lead quite quickly on to your involvement in co-curating the Nordic Pavilion. I mean, this was in collaboration with David Basalto. Could you tell me with this foray out of writing for Arc Daily and into more established or more, in a way, traditional modes of curation came to be?
Yeah, I mean, it is a little bit of a strange story. I mean, I'm very aware that I have, let's say, skipped rungs in the ladder as I've moved through the world. But to be quite honest with you, I think I've lived up to them in a decent way. So I'm not necessarily guilty about that. The co-curation of the Nordic Pavilion at the Venice Biennale was a very random thing. No, it the three museums that manage that pavilion of Sweden, Norway, and Finland reached out to David Basulto and they said, "Do you want to curate this?" You know, David hadn't curated anything before. And I hadn't really curated anything, but I had a lot of friends who were curators. And I was sort of, let's say, mingling in this world. And I was understanding, just by standing at the sidelines and looking in, what this was or what this could be. And I could see, I had opinions about where it was done badly and where it was done well. And David invited me into the project because I think he wanted help with it. And of course, suddenly through this process, which was essentially going from, I suppose, nothing to like the, at that time anyway, the most important architectural event in the world, I just ran and I just sort of said, like, I think it should be like this. And I mean, unbelievable naivety, Matthew, like unbelievable naivety. But I don't think naivety is necessarily a bad thing. What we ended up with, of course, was me having, I suppose, a crash course in how to deal with institutions. And institutions, I'm talking about the different institutions that were commissioning this, the institution of the Biennale itself, how one can sort of create a space that is experience-driven, I think, first and foremost, rather than just trying to tell you something. I mean, I was just following an intuition that I don't think I want to tell anybody anything, really. I want them to feel something. I want them to come into this incredible building designed by Sverfan, probably one of the best buildings in the Giardini at the Biennale. A building which, by the way, no one has successfully dealt with, including me, because it's such a strong space. And give people an experience. So what did we do? We did an exhibition called In Therapy. And I just said, I believe that Nordic architecture is dealing with a very strange situation where the history, a certain kind of 20th century history, is weighing down so much, coupled with all sorts of different problems that come with a developed society, namely bureaucracy, means that actually the possibilities in contemporary architecture, we're not seeing great architecture. So what if we sit down with these sort of grandparents, metaphorically, and try to understand where we're coming from and where we're going? And of course, I was waving a flag as someone who was not from these places, which gave me some freedom, but also, you know, gave me some criticism as well. And the main gesture, which was in collaboration with a fantastic architecture practice in Stockholm called Marge Architecture, was to create an enormous timber pyramid that was essentially somewhere between a tribune and a staircase. And for the first time, and maybe the only time in the history of that building, people could climb up and put their heads in between the lamella and stand in the ceiling of this great building. And I mean, that experience itself, it's the thing I'm proud of with that project. Mm-hmm.
It's incredible, the images I saw. It's like this timber ziggurat. And yeah, it functions not only as stairs to the ceiling or the soffit, but as a kind of amphitheater. For public events. But tell me more about the title, In Therapy, which to me, having looked through and engaged with other work by you and your own writing as well, it feels to me very you.
But does it? That's interesting.
Tell me about the decision to title this first exhibition In Therapy. What does that mean? Why is that relevant?
You're asking a very interesting question, which I'm not sure I have a solid answer to. There's a couple of ways to answer that question. Number one is, I think we wanted to provide a little bit of a gentle shock. I don't think that titles of exhibitions are even relevant in the Biennale. I don't think people remembers what the title of an exhibition was called.
No, that's not true.
It's totally true. But we had chaise longue and rugs in the room. So also the idea of, let's say, some sort of Freudian therapy was definitely metaphorically present in the room. I think that there's many answers to this. So one, I think that it was just about trying to get people in the door and trying to get people to understand the content that was in the exhibition, which was essentially the results of an open call, which was something we were asked to do by the commissioners, not something I necessarily wanted to do, to see that content through this lens, to sort of try to sort of create a reflective space that was still attractive, that was rather than sort of asking you just to reflect, was sort of like trying to create some sort of minor context for reflection. I think for me, maybe to respond to your broader question about therapy, and I can totally see how you might be able to trace a certain line from there to now in different ways. Concurrently with all of this process, I'm growing up, and I'm growing up as a queer boy who came from a ridiculously heteronormative society in which, I remember completely as a kid being so frightened about being gay, because like in the 90s or 2000s, like every single ad and every single film and everything was just, heteronormativity. And so, you realize very quickly that you're wrong. You feel that you're wrong, and you feel that you need to prove yourself in different ways, perhaps, because you can't prove yourself in the way that is obvious. You can't just fit in. So you have to find another way of doing it. And I think that for me, even though I've developed a much more nuanced understanding of how you can deal with that, I've always been interested in illuminating the world with a delicate light, shining lights on things that is maybe a softer light. I'm not super into harshness. I'm really into this sort of idea that there are many different kinds of experiences, and that we need to make space for different kinds of experiences of things. So, So maybe you can argue that In Therapy was the first platform that I really got to sort of say, I think this might be a good way to think about things.
It's so interesting because I feel like that title for me, it opens up a door into a different way of thinking about the work you do. But as you've just explained, it's also a deeply personal theme or idea when it comes to your own self-identification, the way you are as a person in the world. And I feel like there are these two aspects of this therapeutic relationship that you're exploring as a curator. And one has to do with exposure or self-exposure or disclosure. And the other has to do with proximity. I just want to read a description you gave about what a curator does in another interview. And I have to say that this interview is given on a birding podcast.
On a what?
It was like a bird watching enthusiast.
Oh, birding. Yeah. Oh, get birding.
Get birding.
The biggest bird watching podcast in the UK.
Sponsored. I was shocked and surprised by Swarovski crystals. I don't know how they.
I know it's a good sign.
Though. Yeah. Anyways, you explained to the birder that a curator is someone who cares for things, who cares for ideas, people, and context, that they need to look and listen closely, and that you talked about design and how design in relation to curation, and that when we think about the world through design, we start to see things more closely. And I feel like the job you've taken on in terms of the kind of curation you do, and maybe this is more broadly applicable to the role of the curator, is to bring us very close to something that may have been overlooked, and to create the circumstances for a very direct an intimate encounter with a thing or an idea, and to have that idea or thing somehow move us or shift our position in the world a bit.
Yeah.
And so to me, that's a very therapeutic scenario.
I mean, thank you. Thank you for that sort of observation, because I'm not sure I've made it before. Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, obviously the idea of curation is the word curator, or curatorial ideas are overused now. And of course, that puts a lot of pressure on the discipline of curatorial practice, of which, you know, there's not many curators of architecture and design in the world. It's in comparison to art curators, for example. And that pressure is interesting, because that pressure forces us to sort of think very carefully about what it's doing. And in the context of a museum, that's also very specific, as opposed to in the context of, let's say, freelance curatorial work. I mean, in that birdwatching podcast, which was in relationship to Studio Assidiana's project that they did at ArcDes called Utomhusverket, like last year, which, for that project, Studio Assidiana brought forward this idea of coexistence between birds and humans being a kind of radical way of rethinking public space. And it actually worked. I mean, I spent most of that summer cleaning bird shit off their installation with a certain kind of joy, actually.
You did talk about that in the interview. That would have been interesting.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, exactly. There's a lot to talk about, let's say, the acts of care that happened around Studio Assidiana's project. But when I think about curatorial practice, I start to think about what it means to nest in the complexity of things. And I don't know where I got this from. I think I remember writing about it once, but I sort of earlier in my career, I described curatorial practice as almost writing as if in capital letters. And so what I like about capital letters is they're very clear, they're very accessible, but it's still language, and it still contains all the gradations of language, all the nuances of language. And I think that finding that balance in everything is really important to what I do. And sometimes I get it right, and sometimes I get it less right, and sometimes I get it completely wrong. But that ambition to not dumb things down, but create space for close looking, close feeling, through experiences, through objects, through the creation or maintenance of conversations, through the construction of contexts, is a very vague thing to say, maybe, but it's easy to do. It's easy to do if you go into it with that ambition and you sort of follow that thread as much as you can. Because also the thing about doing an exhibition, for example, is that you're dealing with unbelievable amounts of like outward pressures, you know, coming in at all times, whether it's money or time or other opinions. You know, you're constantly having to navigate and negotiate to arrive at something that is ultimately time-based. It has a duration. It's going to arrive, it's going to be, and it's going to disappear. And for me, that time before, that time during, and that time after are all equally as important. How one constructs something and takes on that negotiation, how it meets publics, but then also how it resonates. That's the mark of, for me anyway, the mark of doing something that may have offered something to culture.
It's also, again, just to go back to this idea of disclosure or exposure, you have this other practice on the side of your curatorial work, which is writing, where the writing you do, it feeds into and somehow reappears or is extracted from the curatorial text you write, but it's woven into essays which are often profoundly personal. And one of those essays, which was published last year, was actually read aloud by you on the radio station NTS. It's part of this series called Protagonist of the Erotic.
Yeah.
And the essay was called An Island.
Mm.
And this is maybe, I mean, it's been published. I'm assuming you're comfortable talking about it, but let me know if not. I mean, it deals with very sensitive aspects of your own biography and your experience that were spurred on by an illness and convalescence following a surgery.
Mm.
Is this a topic we can get into?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. To recall what I said, I mean,
I can jog your memory. You're weaving together a kind of personal narrative in the aftermath of this, what sounds like quite a scary medical experience, where you're also, in a way, re-encountering yourself as a, this is a bit blunt, but like sexual being, and I think before that, a being who feels.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think that experience made me understand the fragility of the body in which I'm very grateful to have that experience, let's say, before my body starts to fall apart, age 50 or whatever. I mean, because my body will fall apart age 50, I'm pretty convinced. So this experience, which was short but intense, and you know, it completely incapacitated me and made me, I think, understand that there are two things that are important to me, the long view and the very immediate view. And that's something which I think I understood about the way I worked. Like, you know, I'm quite good at building concepts and I'm quite good at details, but I'm not very good at anything in between those two things. And this long view and the short view, what I mean by that is that overarching sort of desire to sort of get somewhere and do something in broad strokes has always been part of my persona. I've always been thinking in long ways, you know, also in speculative ways, projecting. And also that's what architecture asks you to do, no? You're just constantly literally projecting into the world. And that short view is really about the present. And I have a lot of issues thinking about things that are too far away. It doesn't interest me. I'd much rather be very, very in the now. I'm a little bit obsessed with immediacy and presence, and I really like that that aspect to how I operate, because I that translates into also how I operate professionally, and I don't really think there's a massive distinction between the two, this idea of like professional and private. I think that they are continually blending into each other and informing one another, and I think being able to acknowledge that is a certain kind of power, actually. Of course, this approach to things can prove problematic when you're working in big projects, and you know, I can't be so immediate, I can't be so mercurial, which I think is a way that more than one person has described me in the past. But yeah, I mean,
just want to
go for it.
Do you mind if I interject? I'm just conscious that we're speaking quite broadly, and I think we're already venturing into other lines of thought I want to follow, especially around Sawspot, where I think the book opens with the statement that there is so much nowness in the now. These are the ideas that you're already starting to breach or broach.
but both, right?
But before we go there, I want to be brought back into this moment of this particular text, and I want to be brought into this moment of you recovering from the surgery and what sounds like possibly was a near-death experience, if not a very shocking reminder of one's own frailty.
Mm.
And then your experience on this particular island in Sweden as well. Can we wander through that essay a bit?
Yeah, of course we can. Of course we can. Where is it? I'm gonna find it so I can wander through with a certain degree of accuracy.
Okay, I mean, we don't have because to, it doesn't have to be a close reading. It's just I want to understand your experience.
No, yeah.
You know, bedbound.
I understand.
Middle of the pandemic, recovering from the surgery. And then I want to understand what brought you to Langeholmen and what compelled you to write this essay.
The good news is I can't find it, so there'll be no close reading. The reality is that my kitchen window is on the sixth floor. And it's an amazing kitchen window because it looks over the expanse of the archipelagic city of Stockholm. And Stockholm is an incredible city. Stockholm is, you know, I've lived in many different places. I've been to, there's something about the sheer fabric of Stockholm, which these granite mounds coming out of the water, the way the ice freezes over, you know, in the winter and creates these new pathways between the islands. There's something beautiful about the city. And my kitchen window was where I stood for a good 6 weeks, looking out at a world that I couldn't be a part of, you know, high on morphine, basically, or semi-high on morphine, and really unable to move. And it was really the situation that once I stood, you know, I really couldn't, it was an effort to sort of move back to where I was before. So I spent probably for the first time in my life, time just looking and not really being bothered by the fact that I have to do something else, that there's another, there's something else that is going to distract me or pull my attention. And, you know, for some years now, I've been extremely interested in cruising culture as, like, as a sort of a concept.
Cruising culture meaning when it's usually to do with queer culture, where people hook up in public spaces.
Yeah, I mean, to be even more concrete, I mean, historically, it's about gay men searching for sex in the city. Mm. That's basically mm-hmm. it. And this stems from a long history of illegal homosexuality and also a certain built into it of all these ideas around danger and threat and pleasure. And Longhorn is this island that my kitchen window looks out onto and has been historically, still is sort of, less and less, one of the largest, most active cruising sites in Stockholm. And I've walked this island 100 times or more, you know, from end to end. It's not that big. And I've experienced it, you know. I've experienced this island in all of its forms, both hidden or invisible and visible. And I think that going through a process of really understanding, it was a real shift in understanding my body. And I think for like a lot of my life, especially as a child, you know, you go through a process of compartmentalization. You know? You say, well, I'm a mind, I'm a brain, and a voice, and then I'm a body. And for me, the mind and the brain and the voice, as it were more important than the body. The body was just like a vessel to carry this thing, and that was the path I walked, because it was probably the easiest path to walk. But at a certain point, you have to acknowledge that everything is connected. And you know, for me also, like exploring, doing years of research into ASMR, for example, teaches you that...
This is where I wanted to go, yes.
Yeah, that there's something that happens between mind and body that is not, like, that they are not distinct. And that's actually a fairly controversial thing to talk about. I mean, I don't think it's widely understood or widely acknowledged that there is this kind of symbiosis. I mean, it's happened more and more that, you know, we start, when we especially enter into dialogues around trauma, for example, we understand, or it's more commonly understood, that trauma is a bodily thing. It's not just a psychological thing, that muscles and parts of the brain have memories of traumas. But I think that when it comes to, let's say, the fields of architecture and design, which are notoriously 5 decades behind any other field, trying to argue that for a creative field or a creative discipline, I think is still relatively novel.
In a way, what you're describing is, in a very personal sense, this increasing awareness of the complex agreements between body and mind.
Yeah, exactly.
And the fact of the body as a thing that desires.
Yes.
A thing that within which longing is embedded, a thing that feels. And in a way, the essay seems to be informing a sensibility that you bring to your curatorial work.
Mm. Well, the timelines are a bit mixed up, no? Because this came after, but I mean, I think that it is all a bit of a mess, no? It's all a bit of a, everything is happening in parallel. And I think it is easy to sort of like look back on near recent things and draw lines. But I think it's all coming out from the same slightly confused and rather sensitive mind, which is unfortunately mine. Like, it's all coming from this kind of desire to match my curiosity with an actual output. And that's an inward curiosity as much as an outward curiosity. To try to open up the spaces for the conversations that I feel in a combined professional and personal capacity to be important and relevant for this moment we are in. And this moment that we've been in, as it were, this protracted moment for the last 2 years has been a particularly weird one, a particularly challenging one. And of course, a lot of the stuff that we're talking about here, whether it is Soft Spot or whether it's Weird Sensation Feels Good, the exhibition, or whether it's this essay that I wrote, all happened during the last 2 year period. And I think in some ways they're all part of my own attempt to make sense of what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Weird Sensation Feels Good then. This is an exhibition that was put on in 2020 at ArtDes, which is the architecture museum in Sweden, in Stockholm. And it's about ASMR, which I'm sure most listeners are familiar with. But
you should start whispering it in binaural audio.
You know what I was hoping? Like, in a way, I was fantasizing about starting this conversation with you and I listening to some ASMR together to kind of tenderize or relax into discussion. But at any rate, I would probably ask you for a recommendation and at some point in this conversation slip in a bit of ASMR.
Oh, it's very personal, though. But sure, yeah, we can do that.
Okay, well, first of all, could you just explain for listeners who aren't aware what ASMR is and what this exhibition set out to do about it or do with it?
Mm. Well, as you said, ASMR stands for Autonomous Sensory Meridian Response, which means absolutely nothing. It was a series of words coined by someone called Jennifer Allen in 2009, 2010, as a way to put some kind of term to a feeling that was emerging from the internet. And there was a message left on steadyhealth.com on a board by a user called OKWhatever51838, who will never know who they were, who, as far as we know, was the first person to say, you know what, I get this feeling sometimes, and it feels like tingling on the back of my neck, and it happens when I'm focused, or when someone is whispering to me, or when I'm being touched softly, or when I see someone popping bubble wrap. And that thread exploded, and therefore this entire movement was spawned. And it is, I would say, the most important movement that the internet has actually come up with yet, because what it does is it subverts everything that we know about the internet, which is essentially about speed, right? Whether it is the devices that we, most of us, hold in our hands, and the bandwidth of the internet, which is ever increasing, and the platforms such as YouTube or Twitch that allow us to have audiovisual experiences, or, you know, maybe they're not experiences, maybe they're experiences. What ASMR does is subvert all these in favor of slowness. And it creates a space on the internet for people to really relax, to feel something in a sort of strange new framework that I think tells us a lot about how we live today, tells us a lot about where we're going, and it's used as a form of self-medication for anxiety and insomnia. And through all this, we can open up discussions into so many things about emotional labor, about the risks to developed societies, about loneliness, I think, critically. So the exhibition basically, that's what ASMR is, and what Weird Sensation Feels Good tries to do. And we're in a very interesting moment right now because the exhibition was on in 2020 in Stockholm, and it will open in May in London at the Design Museum in a slightly different constellation, expanded. It's a bigger gallery and bits and pieces. What the exhibition tried to do was acknowledge it as a creative field, was acknowledge it as part of the international design discipline, which, as far as I'm aware, is the first time anyone's tried to do it. And I think we because we did it in ArcDes, which is a national museum of architecture and design, of course, the concept of institutionalization, which on the one hand can legitimize something, on the other hand can be very violent, I think was used in an interesting way in the context of this exhibition to make space to talk about it and to sort of lift it out of the realms of taboo which it's been in for so long.
I think it's important in that context to talk about the design of the exhibition itself, which was made in collaboration with, is it ETER or ITER?
ITER.
ITER Architects, Irene Strakuzi and Post New. And the I've only seen images of this, but I also watched the digital or virtual vernissage when the exhibition opened in 2020 to a virtual
which was basically
audience.
The day that like COVID kind of really erupted in Europe, like outside of Italy. It was a frightening time.
It was quite something then that you pulled that together on such short notice. It's a really captivating video. I encourage people to watch it. But you essentially walk us through the exhibition, and there are also interviews with academics and researchers who are studying this nascent field of ASMR. But I think the exhibition design itself is totally fascinating and involves a kind of ripply landscape of I don't even
we
know
call
how
it
to describe
the sausage
it.
Pillow.
Sausage pillows.
There you go. And then,
they almost look like the surface of a brain or something has been spread out over the expanse of this exhibition space. And then there are these hanging chandeliers of screens and fingers and ear speakers. And it's all incredibly, in a way, it gives me tingles just looking at the images of this exhibition.
Oh, wow.
Can you talk more about...
That's super nice to hear.
Can you talk more about the design of the exhibition, what you're setting out to do?
Yeah, I mean, for me, exhibition design, and this is also maybe coming from just my background now, is incredibly important. Incredibly important. I want to transport people into a world. I want to make space for them to experience something that they might never have experienced and create a unique context for them to engage with ideas and objects and all that kind of thing. And exhibition design is not easy. It really is not, to get it right. And ITER, who are based in Riga, are really, really unbelievably good at understanding not only at designing, but also understanding how concepts relate to design. And this project had about a year of research up until the point where we started to do it. And of course, we have to acknowledge that, I mean, Kieran Long, who's the director here at ArcDes, is the trust that he placed in me also. And even though exploring the kind of expanded field of design, which really does extend to the internet, is part of his mission and the mission that we're all trying to fulfill at this museum. The trust that he placed in the project was unique. You know, not many directors would do that. That allowed me to feel very kind of able to pursue a course. And ITER were very responsive to that. We held a very mini invited competition for the exhibition design there, and through that sort of I understood some different directions. But the direction that ITA presented and the direction that we followed and evolved, again, under all of the constraints of time and money and everything, given that a pandemic was around the corner, and although it wasn't as we were designing this, but that suddenly supply chains and travel was impossible and all that kind of stuff, led to a particularly intense collaboration where in the end, as we were building this exhibition, ITA, Dagny and Niklas Karlis, they were unable to be in Stockholm. So, I mean, I had to stand there with FaceTime and say, all right, guys, I trust that you had a plan as to how this sausage pillar, 1 kilometer of sausage, would be laid out. But I tell you, it's harder in reality than it looks on the drawings.
I was looking at the construction drawings and it was absolutely boggling to me how it was set out, because there is a repeating pattern, but the images suggest otherwise.
And of course, it's also how these behave, no? They have a certain filling and the folds. So, I mean, really, you know, the team here at ArcDes and me, in close collaboration with Ito, who were at a distance, sort of just wrestled this beast into being, and then suddenly the exhibition closes immediately because it's a pandemic. We do the virtual vernissage, which was basically an hour and a half TV show, which I think landed in the world at a particularly useful time, because, I mean, all you had to do was put on some headphones, go into a dark space, lie on your bed and watch, relax, because the fear back then, do you remember, was strange, because no one knew what this pandemic was. And so I think that the whole topic and everything sort of landed at a perfect moment where people were just seeking something that was quiet and gentle, but also somewhat interesting. Mm-hmm. The exhibition ultimately opened, and then we were able to see how people interacted with this enormous sofa, with these strange works on display. And it was one of the most revealing experiences of my entire career, really, to have conversations with people on this vast sausage pillow, to see people falling asleep. I mean, falling asleep in this exhibition was the greatest compliment, you know? And I remember walking in there one morning, as I often did, and seeing an elderly couple laid, sprawled on the sausage pillow in front of an episode of Bob Ross's Joy of Painting, hand in hand asleep. And I was like, wow, this is when an exhibition becomes a public space. This is when an exhibition becomes a space where you can feel something. I mean, to feel vulnerable enough to fall asleep in an exhibition is rare, you know? And it's something that I will, I think, forever try to replicate or try to find alternatives to make people feel that safe in a room that is essentially, yeah, public. Mm. And I think ITA's design, you know, it enables that.
This is pointing to another question that it seems like is front of mind for you, which is, what are museums for today? You had this call for submissions. Let me just find the name of it again. Solicited proposals. Yeah, where you're asking what happens in an architecture exhibition, what and who is it for, what does it do, and how does it do it? So you sent out these this call for submissions or solicited proposals from different thinkers, I think, in the expanded field of architecture. And those essays were published, or began to be published, late last year in December of 2021. Can you tell me what you learned from that exercise? What kind of answers did you find to these questions?
Yeah, I'm still thinking through it myself. I mean, the context of that collaboration with Eflux Architecture and ArcDes was connected to, I think, a question that we're all asking here at this institution, which is, how will we make an architecture and design museum relevant across the next 30 years? Because as far as I'm concerned, they're becoming less and less relevant. And this is a space of real urgency for all of us in society and our acknowledgement of culture. And what do we want? You know, architecture and design are the backgrounds to our very lives. Everybody has a relationship to them, like an embodied relationship to architecture and design. Yet, you know, the kind of materials that an architecture museum holds, such as plans and drawings, are not in themselves particularly interesting to a broad audience. It's all about the stories. It's all about the context. It's all about how, you know, in the words of Kieran, architecture and design relate to public life. And public life is that kind of core, strange concept that's very ambiguous and vague that we work to here, that sort of allows us to think very broadly about all these questions. But solicited proposals was a way to actually say, well, if we're going to ask these questions, we need help to ask these questions. I can't answer these questions. I mean, I've got one perspective on all of them. So we invited a group of people to reflect on an element of the architecture exhibition, whether that was the seating or the duration or the interpretation or the guide or the object list or the brief, you know, all of these things that we just take as given formats or given ways of doing things. And so the ambition we set to each contributor was to try from their perspective to weave together a little narrative about this element and then try to imagine possible futures for it. Like, how would the duration of an experience change in the future for the better? You know, because that directly relates to all sorts of questions where, you know, I would love to have a museum open from lunchtime until 3 a.m. And that's rarely done, but that suddenly changes the entire experience of what it means to be a public space and also how you engage with it. Night visits to a museum is an amazing idea, but it's easy to think about, very hard to put into practice because it has a massive repercussions on the functioning of an institution. So it's sort of like a space to open up these questions, and these questions which have been answered by all these respective contributors, or at least they've claimed a position towards, then allow us to think very carefully about how we might actually do that in reality. And we're really working towards it. We're nowhere near yet, but I do not want museums to die. I do not want institutions to lose their relevance. But if we don't start attacking these questions in a really open way and understanding how these fairly anachronistic models relate to the place in which we are right now, we're not going to get anywhere. And they will slowly die. They will slowly die because the experience of them isn't necessarily attractive, I think, to broad parts of society.
And it really does feel like the exhibition design for Weird Sensation Feels Good is a kind of case in point in how to begin to alter the museum environment.
Totally, yeah.
And to, I mean, as you've said elsewhere, I think, offer something softer or recast the museum as a place of acceptance, reflection, and empathy.
Yeah, precisely. I'm really, do you know how, what do you think about that? Because no one agrees with me, really. Like, they agree with me in principle. But, you know, the idea of an institution swapping from this kind of space of power and top-down sort of, like, information and all that kind of stuff, like, becoming a more passive space, I think for a lot of people it's quite frightening because it loses its kind of core reason for existence. Mm-hmm. But I really don't believe that it does.
Mm-hmm. That interpretation of this possible future for the museum and its role in public life really does resonate with me. But I do see intimations of it already in institutions like the Wellcome Collection. I mean, I'm curious, beyond other institutions, what curator is working today? Which curators working today are inspiring you? Or are there any role models, even historically?
I mean, there are many, right? There are many for often very trivial reasons. I've become more and more interested, perhaps as a result of being in Stockholm. I was in Stockholm for 2 years without moving, you know, which is a very different way of being than I'd been used to, in really understanding the ground, you know, upon which I've been standing and the particular histories of that ground. I have a very critical stance towards Swedish society, as much as I fully appreciate and acknowledge that it's extremely good in many, many ways, that the society that's been built here is in many ways as good as it gets, you know, as far as countries go right now. But there are lots of sacrifices that you make to achieve a society like this. And I work for the government, you know, like ArcDes is a governmental body, so we're very tied to sort of the long history here. ArcDes sits on an island naturally, in the middle of Stockholm, called Skeppsholmen, that has a particularly interesting history as a sort of pleasure garden in the 1600s, and then as a military island which was closed to civilians, also at simultaneously a very popular cruising spot, because where there are sailors, there is gay sex. And then in the 90s and 80s and 90s, it became a sort of cultural space. And one very problematic figure who was part of that movement was Pontus Hultén. Pontus Hultén was the first director of Moderna Museet, which is the Museum of Modern Art here. He was also, I think, the first director of the Pompidou Center. And sometimes when I look at what his career entailed, as problematic as it was in so many ways, he also understood how you build an institution and how you build an institution that feels like a living room. And if you look back at the very old images of the institutions that he created, centering on Moderna Museet, you see a space that is just alive, you know, that really feels part of the world it's in, part of the society it's in. He went on to be part of the advisory team that led to Kulturhuset, which is a big building, modernist building in the center of Stockholm, designed by Peter Selsing, that was, I think, in many ways, the precursor to the Pompidou Center. It's a vast, as I said, it's a large facade which faces one of the biggest public spaces in the center of Stockholm, which is all glass. And on that glass facade, you see all these floors and you see all the functions, from the cinema to the dance theater, to the art exhibitions, to the library, to the chess area, to the children's area. You see it laid out in front of you in this typically modernist way. And that's exactly what the Pompidou, I think, became conceptually. Pontus Hultén is somebody who I think understood how space, architecture, concepts and experience meet. And I sometimes do, I think, model things so I certainly model, like, let's say, ambitions on, I think, the better ambitions that he had. When it comes to right now, I'm not sure I would pick anybody out in particular. I have so many ongoing conversations with people. I find it very difficult not to become friends with people I work with. And then that becomes a very interesting negotiation ultimately when you start working together again. But I'm not. But I don't want to know somebody. I don't want to know half of somebody. I want to know all of them, because only then can interesting things come. And when I look at, for example, Shumi Bose, who you've interviewed before, curator and teacher in London, Space Popular, who you've interviewed before, who I've worked with and have a very close relationship with now and an ongoing conversation, to all sorts of people that I'm around, that are around me now in Stockholm, like Marie-Louise Richards, who is a lecturer on the Decolonizing Architecture course at the Royal School of Art here. These are my friends, but they're also my intellectual sparring partners. And maybe it infuriates them from time to time. I don't know, I should really ask them. But my intensity is in understanding how they see the world. My intensity is understanding how they see what I'm doing. My intensity is on how we can think through things in a careful way. And thinking through things in a careful way might be in a car ride from somewhere to somewhere, or it might be on a FaceTime call, or it might be over text message. The people that I just mentioned there are a group of many, many more that inspire me in very small ways. And I think it's so difficult to sort of pass, or it's so difficult to sort of unravel this tapestry, you know? Like, some threads are stronger than others, or some threads continue longer than others, but it's a tapestry, and it's sort of, it makes up a picture which then transforms itself into maybe not what I write, for example, but how I write. Maybe not what I pursue as research or towards an exhibition, but definitely in how I do it. I could keep on going, but you should probably interrupt me.
I should. I think further to that point, this is probably the last question or last topic I want to cover, which is how you came to write Soft Spot. I'll leave that question there for you to respond to, and then I'll come back in with more specific questions. But how did you come to write that book?
this, so SoftSpot was a very intense collaboration with OKRM, as a sort of London-based graphic designers and sort of creative agents. I think they're also very difficult to sort of pin down to a single discipline or practice. And it stemmed from a series of conversations that were happening just before early pandemic. And I think that none of us at that point knew what it was going to be. And we really went in circles for a long time. You know, we had moments where we didn't talk about it for a while, and then we would talk about it very intensely. And even I can't really tell you how it sort of took the shape that it did. But I do think that the shape it has is very strange. The shape it has is slightly erratic, but very, I think, representative of two things. One, where my mind was across the span of a year in different moments, but also how a collaboration, like the results of a collaboration between me and OKRM, which was very, very, I think, was a very intense experience for all of us. Yeah, I mean, it's a bit vague, but it was very vague.
Can we just try and explain the format of the book itself? I mean, it reminds me in a way of work by an artist named Douglas Copeland. I'm sure you're familiar with. There are episodes in the book, and there are chapters, and interspersed throughout are short essays, but then folded in between the essays are these declarative statements, almost like bold slogans. Mm. And there is kind of grainy imagery, photography, and there's this common thread of close-up portraits of tree trunks as well.
By Max Creasy, actually.
By Max Creasy. I mean, it's a complex mixture of different communicative modes, from the incredibly short form slogan to the kind of personal essay. And the experience of reading it is not unlike the experience of being online, or maybe better, the experience of being within one's own head and I guess watching oneself think. So to me, it was a really intimate experience. There's this one passage that I feel like maybe most efficiently unlocks what the book is pursuing. So you write that, as time slows and stretches, my sense of self-assuredness dwindling in parallel, the more I can cherish the ways in which I, and those I'm near to, feel. Inklings, impressions, instincts. These are the bodies that commission the brain. They are a privilege. They guide the fragile hand that reaches out into the world in an attempt to feel and be felt. And I feel like I could be authoring those lines alongside with you as I read them, in terms of trying to summarize my experience of this text or of this book project. And so in a way, we're kind of in the nest, as you framed it before in this book.
Yeah.
But
and I stand by those words. I've become more scared as the years have gone by. I've become more, it's not scared as in fear. It's more just scared as in fragile. And I think that ideas are fragile. I mean, stability is hard to find. And I think that yet within all that, there is this understanding of immediacy, which I think can help abate those concerns. I think that there is an acknowledgement of feeling, and you know, I mean, people could describe me as a snowflake, you know, like on the verge, like some sort of in this generational bridge, which was sort of arbitrarily drawn by whoever. But when I look at people, you know, when I have exhibitions like Where Sensation Feels Good, and I see people who are 60 years old and I see people who are 16 years old, like I see very different expressions in the world, but I see this exact same desire, which is to feel. And I think being able to talk about that and pin that as an ambition and then negotiate what that means through all these different formats, like whether it's writing or exhibitions or just having a conversation, is like absolutely, it's becoming more critical to what I think that my purpose might be within these fields and within the skills that I have to offer to an enormous cultural context. And I have to say that I do see, this is not just me spouting this, you know, that I see institutions, I see people around the world also following these lines of inquiry, which makes me wonder that maybe this is just something about our time, about the time that we live in. Maybe this is a natural progression of where we've been. But you know, I don't know, curatorial practice is very collaborative, right? And writing is very lonely. Or it's for me anyway, it creates an intense solitude. But I still pursue it. I'm writing right now the sort of first piece of near future fiction that I've ever written, which is set actually in northern Scandinavia and is dealing with utopias and dystopias and is trying to understand where we're heading, and it's so lonely to write this kind of stuff. You're literally with yourself, and I think that the balance between the solitude of writing and the collaborative nature of like birthing something into the world that can be experienced is a balance that I need, because I can't do one or the other, and I think that they relate to each other. But in between all this, like, I also just want people to have fun. Like, I want to have fun myself. Like, I want people to experience a certain kind of magic. Because without magic, there's pretty much nothing left, really, you know? It's like, whether it is the experience of reading a few words or the experience of walking into a room, like, I kind of think that if you're not making space for a certain kind of magic, then there's no point. Because I want to have fun. I don't have enough fun, really. And I want more fun. Do you have fun?
James, this was a lot of fun for me. So thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, it was really fun to talk to you.
You've been listening to Scaffold. I'm Matthew Blunderfield, and I produce the show. The theme music is composed and performed by Luke Blair. Subscribe to Scaffold on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at @scaffold_podcast. If you like the show, spread the word and leave a rating on iTunes while you're at it. Thanks to James Taylor Foster. Special thanks this week to Rory McGrath, Shumi Bose, Max Creasy, and Frederick Helsberg. Thanks as always to Scandal Lynn, and thanks to you for listening. I'll see you again next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.